Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Corbett Report. I'm your host, as always, James Corbett, and today is June 16th, a.k.a. FLNWO Day, and I surely hope that all the good boys and girls in the class have done their homework today, because we have a doozy to dissect. I'm referring, of course, to Charlie Wilson's War, the 2007 Hollywood drama starring America's national treasure, Tom Hanks, and sweetheart, Julia Roberts, based on the true story of the quote-unquote true story of Charlie Wilson, the sleazy Texas congressman with a heart of gold who takes up the Afghans' cause after visiting a refugee camp during the Soviet-Afghan War. He then uses his leverage on the Hill to drum up quote-unquote $500 million in the quote-unquote largest covert operation ever, nudge nudge wink wink, which is a complete success in terms of getting those damn Ruskies out of Afghanistan. But what have they done if now a bunch of stirred-up crazies are converging on Kabul like it's a second Mecca? Dun-dun-dun. Yes, what could possibly be wrong about a narrative like that, presented by those wholesome folks in Hollywood? Well, joining us today to tell you exactly what is wrong with a narrative like that is our old friend Pierce Redmond of Porkins Policy Review at the carpal tunnel-inducing address porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. Or you can just go to CorbettReport.com and click on the link in the show notes. Pierce, thank you as always for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me on the show again, James.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being here. And I really am excited to talk about this. And I'm excited to have the opportunity to talk about this movie because it was one that came up in a conversation that you were having talking about predictive programming and Wag the Dog. And I heard you mention Charlie Wilson's War as another very interesting example of the type of predictive programming that comes out of Hollywood. And that's set off a series of triggers for me because I knew about the movie. And I had read a lot of articles about the movie when it came out and what it was about and sort of the inaccuracies of it. But I actually never saw the movie until today. I actually watched it today for the first time ever. So I'm absolutely fresh off of watching it. So actually my first ever experience of actually seeing the movie was today. Obviously 7 years deep into the Corbett Report and somewhat, I would like to think, somewhat well versed in the Soviet-Afghan War and what was really happening there. So I understood exactly what this movie was trying to do and what it was about. But I understand that your first experience watching this movie happened in a very different context.
Yeah, I actually went and saw this movie when it came out in 2007, I think, with my father in the theater, and it did have a somewhat profound effect on me at the time. And this was just before I was going into college, and my mind was still sort of wrapped up in the official story of 9/11 and certainly the official story of Al-Qaeda and the Soviet-Afghan War. And yeah, this movie really kind of did a number on me for a while and was very good at sort of pushing away all these little nagging questions that a lot of people, I think, had at the time, especially in 2007 when it seemed like U.S. foreign policy was just so horrible on so many levels. And this movie really helped to kind of reinforce those notions that, no, this is, we did fund the Mujahideen, but we didn't fund Al-Qaeda. No way. That was just those crazies, those stirred up Muslims, as Brzezinski would say.
You know, if that movie had come out in 2005 or 2006, early 2006, and if I had seen it at that time, I think I would have had the exact same reaction to it, because it does fit so nicely into a certain model of understanding of what happened during that era. And it's a model that, in fact, you and I talked about in our first conversation when you had me on your program to talk about the idea of blowback.
Yes.
Blowback. Yes, of course, this is one of the main underlying themes and, of course, very heavily dropped in at the end there of the movie. So for people who have, I hope everyone who's listening to this has watched the movie by now, you'll know what we're talking about, where blowback definitely becomes the very explicit theme of the end of the movie and, of course, ends with a quote from Charlie Wilson very explicitly talking about that. And, of course, in our conversation about blowback back on Porkins Policy Review, of course, we mentioned Chalmers Johnston, who wrote the book, literally the book on blowback. And wouldn't you know it, Chalmers Johnston, of course, wrote a piece on Charlie Wilson's War called Imperialist Propaganda, Second Thoughts on Charlie Wilson's War. It's up at tomdispatch.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. And wouldn't you know it, he takes the movie to task for not being enough, promoting enough the idea of, wait for it, blowback, yes. I'll just read the operative paragraph from the review. In a secret ceremony at CIA headquarters on June 9th, 1993, James Woolsey, Bill Clinton's first director of Central Intelligence and one of the agency's least competent chiefs in its checkered history, said, "The defeat and breakup of the Soviet Empire is one of the great events of world history. There were many heroes in this battle, but to Charlie Wilson must go a special recognition." One important part of that recognition, studiously avoided by the CIA and most subsequent American writers on the subject, is that Wilson's activities in Afghanistan led directly to a chain of blowback that culminated in the attacks of September 11th, 2001, and led to the United States' current status as the most hated nation on Earth. So exactly what you're talking about there, Pierce, with your own personal experience of this movie back in 2007, still trapped in that propaganda matrix and understanding it from within that rubric. Of course, the blowback theory is so appealing because it connects so many of the pieces of this puzzle in a way that that allows us to understand how we went from 9/11 to Iraq, for example, and how it all pieces together, and it all goes back to Afghanistan, and it's all one piece of a puzzle. So it puts it together in that way that's intellectually appealing. But of course, it's not really an accurate picture of what really happened, is it? So let's start dissecting a little bit about this. And I guess we'll start now at the end of the movie as we're talking about that and the idea of this blowback. Why don't we talk about the excluded pieces of this story from the movie that basically counter the narrative that we're supposed to believe, that this was all just some, random happenstance. Wouldn't you know it, somehow or other, all these arms ended up in the wrong hands, and wouldn't you know it, 9/11 happened.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we could even just quickly start before the events in this film. You know, the movie more or less starts in 1980, but you could go back as far as 1973 in Afghanistan and look at the history there, which they completely leave out. Now, obviously, this is a Hollywood movie, and there's a limited amount of time, and the movie is fairly long as it is. But just looking back there, I mean, we've got a series of coups that gets rid of the monarchy in Afghanistan and puts in power the PDPA, which is the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, which is communist, and for a time is ruled under a man called Mohammad Dawood Khan, but, you know, it's plagued with problems. And then in around 1978, he is overthrown in another coup, and this brings in a man by the name of Taraki, and he struggled very much with the Mujahideen. And as is not pointed out whatsoever in the movie, the Mujahideen existed in the late mid to late 70s in Afghanistan, and they were funded by two of America's great, wonderful proxies at the time, and one still is, Pakistan and Iran. And, you know, of course, this is completely left out whatsoever in the narrative. And I think that that's an important part in sort of dismissing this notion of blowback, because, as I was saying, these groups existed already, and the U.S. was helping to fund them, you know, in the late 70s, sort of not so much. But yeah, you know, this was going on. And
That is so important, and let's take a moment to reflect on that, because it's something that I'm not sure I would have really noticed or thought about if I was watching this movie without knowing much about the Soviet-Afghan War, but there really is absolutely no context to this war provided. All it is you see, there's these Russian helicopters strafing these Afghans, and who knows why, they're commie pinkos. I mean, this is what they do, basically, is sort of the narrative. And I think, from the logic of the story, it just, you know, you just go with it, and it just makes sense, so you don't think about it. But it's a pretty important thing. How did this war start? Where did it come from? What was the purpose? And just to highlight what you're talking about there, the kind of disconnect between the official story of the Soviets just kind of spontaneously invaded and the America was so appalled at it, versus the truth of what you're talking about, that there was support to the Mujahideen before the Soviets invaded. Let's look actually at state.gov, the official State Department website, has its official Soviet invasion of Afghanistan history, which again I'll link in the show notes, and it says it gives that spiel you're talking about with the 73 coup and then the 78 counter or continuing coup and all of that back and forth within the PDPA. And it gets to the point of the kind of Soviet buildup and then the invasion. And it says, although the Carter administration had closely watched this buildup from the outset, its reaction following the invasion revealed that until the end, it clung to the hope that the Soviets would not invade based on the unjustified assumption that Moscow would conclude that the costs of invasion were too high. In response, Carter wrote a sharply worded letter to Brezhnev denouncing Soviet aggression, and during his State of the Union address, he announced his own doctrine, vowing to protect Middle Eastern oil supplies from encroaching Soviet power. The administration also enacted economic sanctions and trade embargoes against the Soviet Union, called for a boycott of the 1980 Moscow Olympics, and stepped up its aid to the Afghan insurgents. Oh, no. Boycott of the Olympics. It sounds vaguely similar to run-up of what we're seeing now. In sum, these actions were Washington's collective attempt to make the Soviets' adventure in Afghanistan as painful and brief as possible. So this is the actual official history of the State Department that's up on the website today, last modified October 31st, 2013. Which, of course, goes exactly counter to the admitted firsthand personal account of Carter's national security advisor and no stranger to Corbett Report listeners, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who in 1998 provided an interview to Le Nouvel Observateur that I've quoted before, but let's just quote it again. He said in that interview, quote, according to the official version of history, CIA to the Mujahideen began during 1980, that is to say, after the Soviet Army invaded Afghanistan on December 24th, 1979. But the reality, closely guarded until now, is completely otherwise. Indeed, it was July 3rd, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. And then the interviewer asks him, oh, well, so you actually tried to provoke the war? And he says, oh, it wasn't quite like that. We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. So I don't know what the difference is there, except something happening in Brzezinski's mind. But anyway, so the official history on the State Department website goes counter to what Brzezinski has publicly admitted about Operation Cyclone, as we now understand it, which, again, did start before the Soviet invasion. So So you can see how a Hollywood production could completely leave that part of the story out and no one would blink twice about it, because, again, no one even questions the State Department on this propaganda that they put up on their website. It's just another infuriating part of all of this, that the propaganda isn't even sophisticated. They just lie. Yeah. They just flat out lie.
Mm, yeah, oh, absolutely. And, I mean, the only time we ever see the Russians in the movie, in Charlie Wilson's War, is when they're butchering women and children in helicopters. There's no context, there's no explanation about why they're there. And again, just going back in history a little bit, the Soviets did not want to go there whatsoever. And it took several years of the Afghan communist government pleading with them to send arms and weapons and advisors and stuff. And eventually the Soviets did acquiesce. And in large part because they saw that the United States was funding the Mujahideen. And, they saw this as some sort of, foreign element in their perceived sphere of influence. So they did want to get involved. But, again, this is totally left out. There is no explanation. And instead it is just that, the Soviets hate religion. So they want to go and wipe out all the Muslims and oppress them. And God forbid, if Afghanistan goes, then the rest of the world will soon follow after that. That's the kind of storyline that were presented in Charlie Wilson's War.
That's exactly right. Again, an extremely important part of the story that's left out. And there are so many others, but I think one of the most glaring is a pretty interesting one. In fact, it's not, again, it's not an excluded part. Well, it is partly excluded. It's partly a lie. In the film, they quite explicitly mention that the U.S. support is ultimately ending up in the hands of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who, of course, was the leader of the Northern Front, the Northern Alliance, whatever they were called, who was whose name should ring a bell to those who are interested in 9/11, because, of course, he was assassinated 2 days before 9/11 in a fake interview where the fake interviewee smuggled in a camera bomb and blew him up. An interesting piece of that puzzle, and perhaps related to 9/11 itself, but the movie explicitly mentions his name just in passing, just I believe in one single reference. Where is this money ultimately going? It's going to Ahmad Shah Massoud and the Northern Alliance. Very interesting, because of course that is not true. There's an excellent article up on Alternet by Melissa Roddy, Tom Hanks Tells Hollywood Whopper in Charlie Wilson's War, where she writes about this and cites Milt Bearden, the CIA chief of station in Pakistan, who, again, I hope will be familiar to longtime viewers of the Corbett Report, because I put him in my last word on Osama bin Laden, where he actually said, I think it was on 9/11 itself, it might have been 9/12, they had him on CBS, I believe, and he said, Osama bin Laden is the perfect, I don't think he used the word boogeyman, maybe he used the word enemy, but he said something to the effect of, if he didn't exist, the CIA would have had to invent him. He actually said that on air in the hours after 9/11. Pretty interesting. Anyway, Milt Bearden is kind of the go-to guy for the official story of what happened in Afghanistan, and he admitted Massoud received less than 1% of the CIA, of the U.S. money that was filtering through there. More than 40% of it went to Gulbaddin Hekmatyar. So, who is Gulbaddin Hekmatyar, Piers?
He is one of these brutal warlords who existed in Afghanistan. He didn't just come out of nowhere. This guy existed for a while there. He was extremely powerful, and he was somewhat religiously oriented, and he was sort of the ISI sort of go-to guy in funding. And
right, and just for the listeners, the ISI is the Pakistani intelligence service, the CIA of Pakistan, basically.
Yeah, and Pakistan had a very good working relationship with him, and Hekmatyar was able to appeal to the Pashtuns, which they sort of mention that in Charlie Wilson's War when they're talking about Massoud and where the money is going, and they make mention, oh, he's a Tajik, so the Pashtuns don't like him very much.
The Tajiks have a saying, when they're looking for a good woman, they find a Pashtun man.
And again, all of these sort of serious things are done with that in the movie, where it's sort of a little joke, like, isn't this funny? And Philip Seymour Hoffman makes them, it's funnier in the original Pashto. But it's not really that funny. And in reality, this is where most of the money was going. And again, as the ISI was flooding him with money, he was then flooding groups like the Taliban, like Al Qaeda, and the Arab Afghans as well. And so this is really where the money in fact was going. And again, he was very connected to the heroin trade, which is one of the, biggest glaring, things in the movie that is just not touched upon whatsoever is the heroin trade. And he was deeply involved with that as well. I believe he's still around. He's still kicking it in Afghanistan, right?
You know, I actually have no idea what he's doing today. I have no idea if he's alive. I it's certainly possible. I honestly don't know.
Quote me on that. I'm not sure.
Well, yes, you're exactly right. Obviously, he was intimately connected and a man on the ground for the facilitation of the opium trade, which, of course, has been and continues to be to this very day an absolutely essential part of Afghan operations. And, of course, we'll point to the works of Peter Dale Scott for more about that and The Road to 9/11 and other places where he mentions what was happening in Afghanistan and how this all connects into BCCI, the Bank for Crooks and Criminals International. Which was a key part of the funding in the early stages of this operation before it became the quote-unquote largest covert operation in CIA history. And I think we should at least tackle that idea, because I think that idea is ridiculous. I mean, as if the real most the largest CIA operation in history, covert operation in history, is actually public knowledge, right? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Trust us.
Oh
on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they would make a Hollywood movie about it.
Yeah, exactly. Celebrated in a Hollywood movie. And but here's something I didn't understand about the movie, and I don't think this was. Well, I don't know if this is propaganda, but I didn't understand. They were talking about so Charlie Wilson was on this Defense Appropriations Committee, and the basically the premise of the story. In fact, it was described quite well in a 9/11 blogger piece by Reprehensor, who wrote that this is a Cinderella story where that came out of nowhere. That they present this as if, you know, Charlie Wilson kind of stumbled onto this and took it up as a cause, and just suddenly he was on the Defense Appropriation Committee, so basically managed to, you know, pull some strings and get the funds flowing. And the movie makes a big point about how, you know, at the end, the Appropriations Committee manages to get $500 million sent over for the aid to the Mujahideen, and that's matched by $500 million from Saudi Arabia. So that leads to a grand total of $1 billion. Yes, billion with a B. And Julie Roberts, you know, is startled at the figure. But the official history, this isn't disputed. I've heard this in a lot of places, $3.5 billion, and I've heard $5 billion as well kicked around in terms of total funding. So I'm not sure if there was just other funding going on other than that Defense Appropriations Committee that's portrayed in the movie, or if they got their numbers wrong. I don't know what that was about.
I think it was a deliberate, you know, mischaracterization. Yeah, I've heard exactly as much as $5 billion. And, I mean, again, when we're talking about covert ops, drug trafficking, we mentioned BCCI. I mean, these are massive financial institutions when you get down to it. And even something like $5 billion is a lot, but I could easily see it being much more than that. I think it's a mischaracterization. I think that people, I know when I saw it, I was like, $1 billion now. I mean, that is a lot of money, especially in the 80s. The idea that the largest covert operation in history, that they would make a Hollywood film about it, is very interesting in and of itself. And sort of along the same lines, and so, you know, in the periphery of Operation Cyclone, what do we have is of course Iran-Contra, another one of these very big, very financially lucrative covert operations going on, and, you know, no mention whatsoever, despite the fact that, you know, Oliver North and a lot of these other characters were on the periphery involved in Operation Cyclone. I mean, this was all sort of, if we could, you know, we can kind of look at it as one big kind of global operation. And again, Iran-Contra, Iran was involved somewhat in the Afghan-Soviet War, even later into the 80s as well. But yeah, I mean, there's you know, these covert operations, there's a lot more going on. There's a lot of, you know, wheels in motion. So yeah, to think that $1 billion, and that's really nothing. You know, nowadays, I mean, and we're also talking, you know, they make it seem in the movie that the CIA, and this is, you know, classic CIA propaganda in Hollywood, that the CIA is this sort of ragtag group of patriots, you know, who are a little bit odd, kind of quirky, but ultimately they're beholden to this one obscure congressman, as the Pakistan station chief says in the movie. You know, how does this guy of no particular importance, how is he controlling this whole thing? And you know, the CIA has no budget. And they do kind of say that in the movie, but they, you know, they say, oh, well, it's an unlimited budget, but yeah, we still have to go through Congress. And the idea, again, that the, you know, the CIA is beholden to this obscure congressman of no particular importance is so ridiculous. And it just sort of reinforces this whole notion that the CIA is good and that ultimately there is someone, you know, in charge of the purse strings. Whereas in reality, the CIA can either just make up the money out of nowhere, or what they do more likely is they use things like drugs or banking and things like that. And you can just create this money and use it for whatever you want. But, you know, but that's a running theme throughout the whole movie, this idea that, yeah, Charlie is really kind of controlling this whole thing. And I think that's I think that's ultimately kind of why we know the name Charlie Wilson, so that we can kind of look to him and say, oh, yeah, that was the guy who helped fund, you know, the operations and Operation Cyclone.
Right, exactly. And I know I know the sense in which you mean that, why we know the name Charlie Wilson. But, of course, we know the name Charlie Wilson because we're talking about Charlie Wilson's War. It's literally called Charlie Wilson's War. I mean, it's just the most blatant piece of propaganda of all of it. I mean, it's the title of the movie, which is pretty blatant. But you're exactly right about that. It does try to hang it all on Charlie Wilson and make it look like everything is just going around because this one congressman went to this one refugee camp and had this, you know, saw the light and whatever. And you're right. I mean, it is such a ridiculous story. They kind of touched on this. I was watching some sort of not behind the scenes, some kind of, you know, extra interviews with the actors kind of thing on YouTube, and I'll put the link in the show notes if I'm indeed thinking of the right thing that I was watching. And they actually said something to the effect of, basically, Charlie Wilson was such a notorious kind of womanizer and booze hound and didn't really, I mean, wasn't taken seriously by anyone.
Good time, Charlie.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it worked so well, because the Soviets saw that this was, you know, coming through this congressman and that no one took seriously, so they didn't take it seriously or whatever, something like that. So even that even kind of figures into the official story. But you're right about that. But on that note, I mean, one of the interesting little things that they threw in there, obviously, is just kind of a jokey joke scene. But I think it, if you stop to think about it, has some interesting implications. Is the scene where he's in his office, Charlie Wilson is in his office, and he's dealing simultaneously with Gust, whatever his name is, the CIA liaison on who he's working with, and he's also dealing with this scandal, this Justice Department investigation, the task force that's investigating basically drugs and corruption in Congress and Senate. And so he's sending the CIA guy out of the room, and then his staffers come in and tell him about the Justice Department thing and the PR thing that they're writing to answer the press about the investigation. And then they go out and the CIA guy comes back in, and they're doing it that way so that the CIA liaison doesn't hear any of this. And then he comes back in and basically repeats part of the conversation, and Charlie Wilson, Tom Hanks, gets angry and says, you know, how did you hear through that door? And he said, oh, I didn't, I bugged your bottle. And so there, he's got a bug on, like, he gave him a bottle of whiskey as a present. So he's got a bug on this bottle, and he's listening to what the congressman says. And they just kind of casually insert, yeah, the CIA is spying on Congress, as just this kind of jokey type of thing that's just kind of dropped in there. Oh, you CIA guys, you're so wacky. As if the implication, I mean, I think that really does, I mean, probably not like that, but I mean, that type of spying. I mean, we have Russ Tice and others talking about the NSA spying on congressmen and others. So, I mean, I'm sure that really does go on, but that's an incredibly profoundly important thing for this illusion of republic, the representative democracy that supposedly exists in the United States. Yeah, the intelligence services are spying on congressmen. So I just thought that was just interesting, because obviously I think they just meant it as just some sort of joke dropped in there. But if you actually stop and think about the implications of that, that's pretty interesting. But it's you're exactly right. That's in the context of sort of portraying all of these CIA people. It's just, I mean, they're kind of quirky. They might be geeky. They kind of know what they're talking about on the subjects that they know, but they seem kind of just lost in the bigger world.
Oh, yeah, of course. All of the characters. We've got this guy, Mike Vickers, he's sort of the weapons guy that they go to, and, you know, he's portrayed as kind of goofy, but, you know, super intelligent, and the scene we see with him, he's playing, like, four games of chess with different people, and he knows everything. And this character is still in the Defense Department right now. But, you know, he's one of these guys, Gust, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character. This scene is, you know, he's like funny and he's really committed, and, you know, he's always, you know, he seems to be the kind of the one guy who's sane, and he's, you know, from like a working class family, and, you know, he keeps reiterating this idea that, America doesn't fight religious wars. No, just only ideological ones. And this man, Gust, Advocados, I think is his last name, he was instrumental in, you know, bringing about probably the most brutal government in Greece. You know what I mean? He was deeply involved in this and helped to murder people, helped to put the junta in power in Greece. So, you know, this guy was not a nice person at all, and has made a very, before he passed away, made a very big point of you know, constantly saying that, oh yeah, you know, those certain people, they screwed up the whole Operation Cyclone when they brought religion into this. And again, just going back to Brzezinski, you know, before Charlie Wilson, idiotically dressed up like an Afghan to receive a Stinger missile, you know, Brzezinski was in Pakistan on the border, giving the same kind of speech, talking about that this is a religious war and that you have God on your side. So from the very beginning, this was a religious conflict.
Exactly, and right. And what was the head of the Appropriations Committee who delivered that speech in the movie?
What is it? Doc Long.
Doc Long. I was about to say something slightly different. Yes, Doc Long delivers this speech, and as he was delivering it, I mean, I assumed they were actually using that Brzezinski speech as kind of the template for it, because it is. I mean, it's so obvious once you've seen the Brzezinski footage of him. You know, your cause is right, and God is on your side,
yes.
and it's the exact same scene. Basically, it's just it's Doc Long delivering it in the movie.
Mm-hmm. And throughout the movie, you know, there is this constant theme that's not right, you know, that's bad. And we've got the Julia Roberts character, Joanne Herring, who is this kind of right-wing, anti-communist, Christian conservative, who, of course, seems to use, you know, sex to curry favor with just about anyone who she can, you know, this, you know, morally upstanding woman. That scene is, we can't do that. And Gus is always saying, you know, you got to tell her to tone it down. It's one of these sort of little, you know, covert ways of implanting into the minds of the American public that, right, you know, we were doing the right thing when we were funding these, you know, rural farmers, and that's really what this whole thing was about. And then, unfortunately, damn, you know, a few bad apples, you know, those pesky Pakistanis, they gave the wrong money, the same with the Saudis, and that's what caused all this to kind of go to hell in a handbasket. But of course, this is not really true, and from the very beginning, this was always framed as a religious conflict, in the sense that the Soviets were anti-religion and that they were oppressing the Muslims.
Right. Well, it was largely about protecting the rural farmers, as long as the rural farmers were farming opium for their poppy crop. Yeah, exactly. Well, all right. So, we've talked about a lot of the issues, and there are more, and I'm sure we could continue talking about them. But the question, of course, then becomes, well, how much of this is just Hollywood being Hollywood and making it into a Hollywoodization, and how much of it is deliberately inserted propaganda? And thankfully, we have answers to that. We can turn back to that alternate article that I talked about earlier, where it goes on to note that they talk about that joke that we mentioned earlier, you put two Afghans in a room. When a Tajik man wants to make love to a woman, his first choice is a Pashtun man. But it goes on to point out that this is propaganda that's been inserted into the movie, quote unquote, because it supports the idea that Afghans are just too tribal to get along. They've always fought with each other. As Wilson once said to me, Charlie Wilson, you put two Afghans in a room, you end up with seven factions. The trouble with this idea is that Afghanistan has been a cohesive nation for several hundred years. And it goes on to talk more about that and sort of the fallacy that's implicit in this propaganda. And it goes on to say that the really bad joke was included because when Wilson retired from the House of Representatives, he was so copacetic to Pakistani views that he went to work for Pakistan as their lobbyist at the rate of $360,000 per year. Not bad for an old skirt chasing boozer. So literally Charlie Wilson goes to work for Pakistan after the events of this movie, which, you know, oddly enough, they don't tell us about in the movie. And they also directly address the inaccuracy about Massoud that we talked about earlier, the fact that less than 1% of the funding went to him, more than 40% went to Hekmatyar, but they specifically mentioned Massoud. And it says here in this article, quote, the Massoud inaccuracy was included because Tom Hanks, quote, just can't deal with this 9/11 thing, end quote. And because Wilson and Joanne Herring, played by Julia Roberts in the movie, threatened legal action after reading an early earlier, more honest draft of the screenplay by Aaron Sorkin. Herring was Pakistan's honorary consul to the United States in the 1980s, and as such, enlisted Wilson into supporting the cause of the Afghans. Neither Wilson nor Herring wants history to remember them for their contributions to the events that culminated in 9/11. So, again, still a bit of that blowback meme, but still very, very interesting in terms of the movie itself and some of the influences on it. Tom Hanks just can't deal with this 9/11 thing. Might be a good tagline for the movie itself when you think about it.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's what I mean. I mean, you know, everything in this movie is so deliberate. And when you start kind of dissecting it, and I remember just in preparation for this, reading through things, and of course, you know, Joanne Herring has this quote where she says, you know, I was doing the right thing, and I can't predict the future, so don't blame me for 9/11. And it's, you know, it's sort of just like, well, then maybe, you know, very wealthy socialites in Houston shouldn't be setting foreign policy for America. You know, that maybe
that's right.
They shouldn't be.
That's
traveling.
Right. And that reminds me. Sorry to cut in, but I just remembered now in the movie. Actually, Tom Hanks, Charlie Wilson actually turns to someone sitting next to him and says, "I'm on the verge of violating the Logan Act," which I thought was that was an interesting little reference and very telling, because I was actually thinking that as he was going, for example, to Pakistan to meet the president of Pakistan on an arrangement by this private citizen, Joanne Herring, that had, I mean, obviously he was doing it in an official capacity, but was he representing the U.S.? I mean, to what extent had that been authorized? I mean, I know the Logan Act has never been used in modern history, at any rate, to prosecute anyone, so I know it's kind of a bit of a red herring, but still, I mean, when you have...
Well, just on that, you know, there's a scene early on in the movie where a constituent of Charlie's comes into his office and is screaming bloody murder that he can't put a creche, a nativity scene, in front of a firehouse because the ACLU is upset about this because it's public land. And you know, Charlie Wilson goes through this whole thing about how, I can't influence the judge. That would be breaking the law. And then, you know, again, a few weeks later, he's out lobbying and violating the Logan Act. And so, you know, he can't tell a judge within his own constituency to kind of back off of this, but he can fund the largest covert operation in the history of the world. And again, that's the sort of, not doublespeak, but this kind of this flip-flopping kind of thing that goes on throughout the entire movie.
Yeah.
And again, it's like in so many of these Hollywood movies, especially the sort of the good time Charlie type character, you know, him doing cocaine, that's fine. You know, he can womanize, he can call his press secretary jailbait, that's okay. You know, but if anyone else did that, oh, they would be, you know, a drug addict or they would be evil. But it's okay when Charlie does it, you know, and the same sort of thing that, well, you know, you couldn't influence an American judge. That would be wrong. But yeah, influencing President Zia to, you know, fund the, you know, Mujahideen, that's okay. That's all right.
Right. And that's exactly why I said sleazy congressman with a heart of gold at the top of the podcast here, because that's exactly kind of the way that they treated it. It's this, you know, I mean, it's kind of the charming rogue, the scamp who, you know, breaks the rules here and there, but underneath he's a good guy and he cares about what's important. And I think they wanted to insert that very early on in the story. And that's clearly what that scene about the crash in front of the firehouse is all about. Mm. All right, excellent. Well, exactly right. So this, of course, gets to the aspects of production, and I don't know how deeply you've looked into this, but of course this was produced or co-produced by Tom Hanks, you know, America's national treasure. Everybody loves Tom Hanks, such an upstanding guy. And for whatever his acting abilities or general lovableness or what have you, it's pretty interesting some of the projects he's been involved in recent years, including, of course, Charlie Wilson's War, but... Also, there was a project that he was trying to bring, I believe, to TV as some kind of miniseries or something like that regarding JFK that was going to be, I believe, based on the work of Vincent Bugliosi, who, of course, is just a basic lone gunman theorist, a total nut who denies any sort of conspiracy in JFK. And Tom Hanks was going to try to bring this to TV for the 50th anniversary, and thankfully did not. But I haven't looked deeply into this. I don't know a lot of the details. But do you know any more about what Tom Hanks or any – I mean, what is his connections to this? Why is he so interested in these political subjects all of a sudden?
I am not sure exactly why he is so particularly interested. I mean, one can speculate, and I think that Tom Hanks represents part of that sort of clique within Hollywood that is very concerned with portraying a particular image of America and a particular image of history. Like Tom Hanks and the produced Charlie Wilson's War, along with a guy called Gary Goetzman, who also produced Game Change and Band of Brothers and The Pacific and John Adams and all these historical dramas about America that, you know, Band of Brothers, you know, oh yeah, the Nazis are evil and everything America did was wonderful and, you know, the sort of standard kind of propaganda that we hear. And Gary Goetzman, along with Tom Hanks, also produced Parkland, which is the movie that is based on Bugliosi's book. And, you know, I think that they're just kind of part of this, and there are other people, of course, Angelina Jolie is very big in this. You know, there are lots of different people, but I think that they're just, that's kind of part of the Hollywood industrial complex and this incestuous relationship between the government and Hollywood in, you know, producing these movies with lots of big name actors. And in that movie Parkland, I mean, it's like every famous actor you could think of is in it. And I think they're just sort of designed in order to confuse people and to, I think that, you know, this day and age, especially JFK, you know, most people don't buy this lone gunman story anymore. I mean, it's so just patently false on face value. But I think that especially, you know, this movie came out just a few years ago or a year ago or so. And I mean, there is a groundswell of, you know, support for the idea that this is, that there was more to this than just Oswald. And I think that when that happens, then you get these various Hollywood types who just get all up in a tizzy about that for whatever reason. And, you know, again, they're offered lots of money. They get to, you know, they get to meet with the various politicians and you know, different media figures. And it's fun, you know, and they get a lot of money to make these movies, you know, essentially they're all kind of propaganda. And if you just watch the Parkland trailer, I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous, you know, especially when movies like JFK and again, like I said, there is, you know, like recent polls put it at like 50% of Americans don't believe the official narrative in terms of the JFK assassination.
And nor should they. But yes, you're right about that. And yet the overwhelming, the completely monolithic view that's propounded in all of the mainstream media, of course, is the exact opposite. I wonder how that system works. You know, I forgot to look before starting this podcast, but was there Defense Department or other types of direct government involvement in this movie?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was, you know, Defense Department stuff. But I think even more importantly is a character called Chase Brandon, who was involved in Charlie Wilson's War as a CIA advisor. And Chase Brandon, for anyone who doesn't know, was a longtime CIA operative, foreign operative, all over that region in the Middle East and elsewhere. And he later became the chief liaison between the CIA and Hollywood, you know, the entertainment industry liaison, basically. And Chase Brandon has been involved in all sorts of different movies. I believe Enemy of the State, lots of different movies. And you can go to his own website and he lists all sorts of movies that he's been involved in. But this is a really kind of shady character. You know, I mean, just any kind of CIA operative who then sort of hobnobs around Hollywood, and I think he even lived in Hollywood for a while. But yeah, he was deeply involved in Charlie Wilson's War, and you can believe if he was involved, then certainly there is a very particular story and a very particular narrative that they want to portray, and I think that does come across a lot in the movie.
It certainly does. And I think, if I remember correctly, I believe Chase Brandon was also involved in Enemy of the State, which we talked about in a previous edition of this podcast. So, yeah, he definitely made the rounds during his time as the entertainment liaison there. And just to further the narrative a little bit, what's Tom Hanks' latest project or something that he's been linked to at any rate, whatever that means, whether or not it ever ends up coming to light, is apparently a CIA thriller that Spielberg may end up directing. So there you go. It's
yeah. Oh, and then he was just in Captain Phillips. You know, another right. One of these sort of whitewashes yes. of not only Somalia but that whole conflict as well.
I am so glad I'm so disconnected from popular culture that I don't even, I've heard of a lot of these movies, but I don't even know what they're about. So thankfully.
Yeah, I don't think you're missing out too much.
Yeah. Perhaps it should be my job, my duty to actually slog through this, which I'm doing with things like Charlie Wilson's War. And I'm glad you made me do that because, honestly, it was interesting to see this propaganda happening. And I'm glad I did it in the conscious light of knowing some of the details of this story so that I was not, suckered in by it, as I say, I probably would have been if I'd watched this in, you know, 2005, 2006, somewhere in that time frame. I guess the other part of this, of course, this was a screenplay by Aaron Sorkin, as I think we mentioned earlier, but it was based on a book, by someone whose name is going to escape my memory.
George Krill?
That
I think?
Would be it, something like that. Yes, did you read the book?
No, I have not read the book, no.
No, I have not either, but in some of the articles I was reading, it did say that there were some important differences, including the fact that in the book, I believe it was mentioned that Charlie Wilson suspected Zvi Raffia, the Israeli that he works with to help secure the weapons, was a Mossad agent. So that suspicion was aired, apparently, in the book, but not in the movie. Although, interestingly, there was that scene where Tom Hanks, Charlie Wilson's in the bathtub, and he admits, basically, he says flat out that he's a congressman for Israel on the Hill. And they talk quite openly about that. There are a few, there are a few interesting scenes in this movie that are kind of just slip by as just sort of, you know, one-liners or something, but that are interesting, like that scene, or like the bugging of the bottle scene, or the scene where he's on the plane with what's her name, Julie Roberts, I forget her name already, and he's telling her the story about when he was a boy, and or I don't know if he's telling her.
Oh, yeah,
he's telling someone the story about when he was a boy, and his neighbor kills his dog.
It's chief of staff.
That's right. Yes, his chief of staff, and he's telling her about the time that his neighbor killed his dog, and what he did in retribution. And it's this interesting story about how so he went to the black part of town and drove 96 people to the polls on the day of this this congress, and because it was the neighbor was a congressman or some sort of representative.
I think he was head of like the town council.
Right. Exactly. Some elected office like that. And so he personally drove a bunch of people to the polls on the day of this person's re-election and actually helped to get him unelected, dethroned, I guess. Right. And he says that was the day I learned to love America or something like that.
Right.
Which is, I mean, that's an interesting story in itself because, of course, it does say an awful lot about the representative democracy system as a whole, doesn't it? And sort of what underlies it and what it's capable of, you know, as a tool, basically, for people who can get people to vote. That's pretty blatant there. So I thought there were a few scenes like that, that if you thought about them at a deeper level than what the filmmakers were intending you to think about them, I think they actually, you know, make some interesting points. But of course, I think that was kind of glossed over. I don't think they were really expecting a lot of the audience to pick up on that.
You know, I almost see that, and you see this in a lot of these movies, be it, you know, like Wag the Dog or some of these other movies. There are these little things that are thrown in there, and I almost see that as those are kind of deliberately there. And, you know, we see that with they do make mention of Israel quite a bit in this movie, and it is kind of brushed aside, but I think they kind of put in some of these things to be like, there is some truth to a lot of this. And obviously, you know, this is a Hollywood movie, but they'll put in little kind of nuggets of things for people to kind of be, oh, well, maybe there is something more to this how powerful is the CIA in reality? And I think that the Israel stuff is really interesting. And that's another thing that they like never ever touch on really in the movie. But, you know, we've got this supposed, oh, I can't work with Egypt. And of course, you know, they just signed the Camp David peace accords. And of course, you know, at this point in time, Israel and Egypt were working very intimately together behind the scenes, of course. This idea that they wouldn't send weapons to Afghanistan when, again, in the background, Iran-Contra, Israel was selling weapons to Iran at that whole time. So, yeah, there are a lot of these little interesting nuggets thrown in there. And that one scene on the plane is so bizarre. You know, he tells his story, and I guess, you know, we're supposed to think that's a good thing in America, that if you can just, you know, convince enough people to vote one way that that's for purely reasons that are you know, personal, that that's a good thing. And then, you know, of course, it's like the next scene is him lobbying to send, you know, Stinger missiles into Afghanistan. It's
right.
Like,
yeah.
Again, as if that's some sort of
exactly. Yeah. No, I think I don't know. I think that's intended as a scene that sort of to develop his sleazier side, so that we understand that the reason that he's in office, the reason that he went into government is because he saw the, you know, sort of the power that can come from that action of convincing people to vote one way or another, right? So he kind of sees the, I mean, he approaches it from that corrupt position. I assume that was kind of meant in that context, but again, it is kind of a bizarre scene, and you know, in a movie that's already, as you say, a bit long, they could have cut here and there. It's kind of a bizarre scene to leave in there.
Yeah. What did you think of Rudy Giuliani making a brief appearance?
Yes, he was the one prosecuting that Justice Department task force.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, I read it as a 9/11 reference, right? I mean, it has to be. It's certainly.
Yeah, right,
in
exactly.
A post-9/11 world, there's no way that we can hear Giuliani and not think, you know, the 9/11 mayor or whatever propaganda he wanted to be associated
with.
So, again, I don't know if that was... I'm not sure if that investigation was in real life. I'm sure there was probably something like it, but I'm not sure if Giuliani, you know, prosecuted it. I'm guessing that was actually happened.
I think he did. No,
life.
I think that whole thing was a real thing, and I'd seen quotes of Charlie Wilson talking about his alleged cocaine use, and he gave these very, you know, cheeky non-denial denials where he basically said, "Yeah, I was doing cocaine that whole time," and you know, but you know, I'm good time, Charlie. It's okay.
Yeah.
Just to reiterate this idea that it's Charlie Wilson's war and this whole thing. You sent me an article that I happen to also just be looking at by Robert Perry, and he talks about this unearthed memo that he found in like the National Security Archives, and it's between a guy called Robert McFarlane, who was National Security Advisor to Reagan, and it was a note that he sent to the chief CIA propaganda officer, Walter Raymond Jr., where he basically says, "We got to bring in this guy Wilson into the operation because he could, you know, secure a lot of money and essentially put a liberal face on this whole operation." So it seems that, you know, from the very beginning, there was this effort to obscure what was really going on, again, in the largest covert operation in U.S. history. And I found that really interesting. And again, this idea that, you know, yeah, bring him in. And sure, you know, he can raise a lot of money for us. But of course, there's going to be a lot more money, you know, pouring into this. And
right.
He can
the
kind
public
of be
face.
Cover.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And again, and we're talking about Operation Cyclone as if this is Charlie Wilson's, you know, whole thing. This
right.
is his life's work.
Exactly right. No, that's it. I mean, the key to the movie is in the title. There's not much secret here that they are trying to make this quite explicitly Charlie Wilson's war, and of course it is not. I mean, that's the big lie that kind of pervades everything at this movie. And, you know, if anything else, you know, makes sense, it has to start there. And of course it doesn't. So yeah, exactly right. All right. I guess the last thing that I'd like to think about, is obviously, I mean, the blowback idea at the end, and then, you know, kind of the understanding, obviously, that the audience in 2007 and later has when watching this movie is obviously 9/11. And there are no explicit, you know, references or anything. There's, as I say, Rudy Giuliani, you know, makes that there's the name drop there and things like that. And I believe in one of the last scenes where Gus is talking to Charlie, I believe when he's telling him that Zen Buddhists, Zen master story. And I think it's in that scene at any rate where you say something about, you know, we'll see what's to come with all of this. And I noticed in the background, you can hear a plane going overhead. And I thought that was, I thought that was trying to make kind of a reference, like, you know, let's encode 9/11 in the scene. Right. Anything else you'd like to say about the blowback aspect of it and the ending with Charlie Wilson's quote there?
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, as we were saying at the very beginning, when I saw this movie, I definitely had doubts in my mind. And it, in 2007, I think a lot of people started to kind of come around to this idea that, you know, perhaps this constant stream that we heard from the mainstream media that there's absolutely no connection whatsoever, no connection between the CIA and Al-Qaeda. You know, yes, maybe Pakistan gave money to the Taliban, but not to Al-Qaeda, not to Al-Qaeda. Of course, you know, ignoring the fact that Saudi Arabia was pouring lots of money into Afghanistan, which is very rarely mentioned in this movie. But yeah, I think, you know, and that last quote is just, you know, part this quote by Charlie Wilson about how we screwed up, and you know, but it was glorious, and we changed the world again, as if you know, defeating the Soviets in a war that they were probably always going to lose is somehow changing the world.
Right.
But yeah, I think this the blowback thing is very profound. And as I said, you know, this was one of these movies that kind of convinced me for a while that, okay, you know, these nagging questions, these weird issues that I have, I don't really need to look at them anymore, because I saw this movie and you know, it was funny, and you know, Tom Hanks is surrounded by beautiful women, and you know, he has this great life. But yeah, I think it's just another one of these examples of you know, liberal Hollywood coming in and giving us this this very, you know, peachy keen, wonderful sort of a thing. And ultimately, I think that, you know, it does sort of push the narrative of blowback. You know, in the sense that we see Charlie trying to get $1 million for schools, and he's totally shot down, and seemingly that's how, as Gus puts it, that's why the crazies are pouring into Kandahar. But you know, and it definitely pushes the blowback thing. And I think on top of that, it also pushes this notion that, you know, blowback aside, it was still the right thing to do, and that's ultimately what Brzezinski was saying. In that interview that he gave to the French newspaper, was that, yeah, sure, maybe we did cause Al-Qaeda and all these other things, but we got rid of those commies, so it's all okay, you know? I mean, it doesn't matter, whatever horrible things we did, sure, maybe now, you know, heroin is cheaper than it's ever been and more readily available, but we got rid of those, you know, evil, you know, God-killing communists. So it's all fine, you know? And I think that's the other kind of major message. And I think also the other part of this movie that's profoundly important to understand is that it also continues this kind of mainstream narrative that Islamic terrorism came out of nowhere, and that it suddenly, you know, came on the stage just as the Soviet Union was falling. So again, as one boogeyman disappears, another one rises out of the ashes. And, you know, we never, you know, there's no mention whatsoever of Islamic terrorism or fundamentalism or anything of that nature whatsoever in the movie. And I think that, again, kind of keeps up this narrative. And
well,
you know,
yeah, but I, again, with the Doc Long scene and where he's shouting Allah Akbar at the end, and I think you get the idea, oh, you know, something dangerous is happening.
Right. There. Could be. Yeah. Something is lurking behind, you know, the curtains a little bit. But, yeah, I do think that it just also reinforces this idea that, yes, communism disappeared, but now Islamic terrorism is the new thing, without any context between, you know, is there a connection between these two?
Right, right.
You know, did one sort of, you know, was one, were they both created? Who knows?
right. No, exactly. Of course, that's not explored at all. Well, as you were talking there, it just occurred to me, I'm not sure if we articulated this in our podcast on blowback, but we should have. One of the things that's so deeply establishment supporting about the idea of blowback is that fundamentally the idea is that, yes, it was, you know, it was a good thing that happened that led to a bad thing happening. And the idea is, if we could have just interfered in Afghanistan in a different way, in a way that didn't cause, you know, the blowback that led to 9/11, then it would be good. I mean, that's one of the insidious parts of the whole blowback narrative that, again, I'm not sure we properly, or I'm not sure I properly articulated in our podcast. All right. Okay. We've been talking for a very long time now, and I think we've probably dissected a lot of this movie, although there's probably still a bit more to go. And we'll ask for the listeners' help on that in the feedback section next month. But for the moment, we've dissected this story and we've subjected a lot of the boys and girls in the class here to watching this movie in preparation for this episode. So I'm sorry to inflict the propaganda on you, but I think it is important to dissect the propaganda and see how it works so that we aren't conditioned by it. But as counter propaganda, as deprogramming, is there any movie, documentary, book that you would recommend that tells the real story about Afghanistan?
Oh boy. Off the top of my head right now, I'm not sure exactly if there's any one thing that I can really point to. I mean, I feel like that when I started exploring this, it was a whole range of things. A lot of your episodes, James, dealing with 9/11 and other things like that. I will say, I mean, if you're interested at all, like in, you know, I mean, even in mainstream books, like Ahmed Rashid's book Taliban, I mean, he talks a lot about, he has a whole chapter devoted to bin Laden and his connections to the CIA, and that's a mainstream book that I read in college, you know? And of course, that chapter is always omitted. I would say, actually, if people are really interested in it, and it's a lot, but just the History Commons website is really excellent in dissecting timelines for all of this. And, you know, I would definitely, you know, encourage people to look at the Al-Kifa Refugee Center, which is not mentioned at all in this movie, and was operating throughout this whole, you know, was deeply involved in this whole operation. I'm trying to think right now off the top of my head, and I can't.
Yeah. I share your frustration because I've pieced this together from many, many different sources over the years, so it is difficult to think. But at the very least, yes, I think you're exactly right. The History Commons timeline is a resource that I don't promote nearly enough because it really is so valuable, especially on on things like Afghanistan, 9/11. Just such a valuable resource. So we'll put a link into that, and if there's anything else you can think of before this gets posted,
I'll send it your way.
Okay, excellent. And, of course, that will all be in the show notes at CorbettReport.com. Let's direct people once again to Porkin's Policy Review, and since we've always got new listeners tuning in, why don't you just tell them a little bit about the site?
Yeah, so the website is porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. I know it's a pretty irritating URL right now. But yeah, that's my website, and that's, and you can go there and you can find all of my podcasts. We have quite a few right now. You know, lots of new listeners all the time, and we cover a range of topics, a lot on terrorism and geopolitics, the drug war in Mexico, and I also do cover a lot of things like this, like film and pop culture and how that influences and the predictive programming and propaganda involved in that as well. So definitely come check out the website. And I've had James on the show before, and
and many, many other interesting guests and yourself besides. And let me just say, I know that you said in a not too distant ago podcast, you said something to the fact you were lamenting that in the current state of the alt media, there aren't a lot of really in-depth investigative work going on anymore. There's just sort of surface kind of gloss of daily events, but there isn't a lot of really well done investigative work. And I agree. I lament with you on that point. I've seen sort of a deterioration in some of the quality in the alt media across the board, but I will say that your podcast is one of those beacons out there that really is doing some of that great investigative work. So if people haven't checked it out yet, please do so. And of course, again, that will be linked up in the show notes as well. So Pierce Redmond, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much, James. It was a pleasure talking with you again.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, there he goes, Pierce Redmond, once again, of the very excellent Porkin's Policy Review. I really do hope you will check that out. And that will do it for this month's edition of Film Literature in the New World Order. And we will get to what we're up, what is up on the plate for next month in just a moment. But before we do so, as always, we have the mailbag that we always encourage and invite your feedback on these conversations. And of course, we always try to read some representative sample of that feedback at the end of each episode for the month before. So last month we were talking to Will Morgan about Aldous Huxley's Island. And although we did get several responses in via the contact form and corporate report to that conversation, Unfortunately, I don't think I got a single response from anyone who actually read the book. I suppose I stand to be corrected on that, but it seems like every single person said they hadn't actually read the book. So it's kind of a strange book club we're running here. But there was one piece of feedback that I did want to highlight specifically. It was from Julian, who wrote in to say, I just caught your book review of Island by Aldous Huxley. You might be interested to know that Huxley had a series of hypnotic encounters with Milton Erickson, M.D., the father of brief psychotherapy and naturalist hypnotic techniques. Erickson set up a time travel meeting between a 23 and 52-year-old Huxley in which each questioned the validity of each other's existence. It's all described in Erickson's painstaking style. And he sent in the link, Julian sent in the link to Erickson's Collected Papers, Volume 1, and yes, around page 83 on, you can for yourself read this very bizarre little anecdote about this experiment that Erickson allegedly conducted with Huxley, and again, putting him further and further into a meditative state where he could reach some sort of hypnotic awareness of some realm in which he goes and back in time and meets a previous incarnation of himself. All very, very strange. I'm not sure it amounts to anything of significance, but at any rate, I will put the link in the show notes so you can go and check it out for yourself. So, Julian, thank you for that. Thank you also to Daniel, who wrote in actually before this month's conversation with some references and links that he thought would be interesting for Charlie Wilson's War. And we did use, actually, one of those links, the global research link that he sent in, Hollywood's Dangerous Afghan Illusion. So thank you very much, Daniel, for that. And again, I'm always happy to accept and to look at any suggestions that people have for upcoming episodes in terms of when we announce what we're actually looking at. If you have any resources on that particular book or movie, by all means, let me know. Once again, of course, you can reach us at CorbettReport.com, so you can send in your feedback about this month's conversation, hopefully after having actually watched Charlie Wilson's War, and I'll be happy to read some of that feedback on air at the end of next month's episode. And of course, that brings us to the question, what is next month's Film Literature in the New World Order episode all about? And it turns out we are going to be reading B.F. Skinner's Walden 2. B.F. Skinner's Walden 2. So, of course, the link to that book will be in the show notes, so you can check out more information about it. And we will be talking about that on July 21st, 2014, with an interesting guest who will remain nameless for now. So looking forward to talking to you then. Once again, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and please do go to CorbettReport.com for all the show notes. Also, please note that the Film Literature in the New World Order podcast is up on iTunes for people who are interested in who use iTunes and who want to subscribe via the iTunes store. Of course, this podcast is no longer on the podcast feed of CorbettReport.com. It's now on its own separate podcast feed. That feed is also available up on iTunes. I'll put the link in the show notes, so please do check that out. And please do rate and review and share that link to the iTunes store version of this podcast, because that apparently does help to get it some more visibility on the iTunes store. On that note, once again, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, thanking you for joining me, hoping to talk to you again real soon.